So my advice to myself, and my advice to, younger people, is generally like find whoever is doing the thing that is the closest thing to your dream and just like go ask them how you can help. And that passion and curiosity and follow through is far more important than your existing skill set.
Today, I'm speaking with Keith Kmita. Keith is a computer programmer and mathematician whose work brings together a variety of disciplines to provoke thought and promote social change. He has created video games, bioinformatics programs, musical applications, and biotechnology projects featured in Forbes and NPR. In this episode, we mainly focus on his work heading Lifespan.io, a life extension advocacy group. We discuss the institutional perception of DeSci, the philosophical role of a finite lifespan, the importance of studying history and tech, and much more. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy our conversation. So, Keith, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, how would you describe the work you do? I know you do multiple things. Would be curious how you're expressing that.
Yes, too many things, some might say. But where your audience probably knows me most likely is as the president of Lifespan.io, which is a 501c3 organization, a nonprofit, which raises funds and awareness for research aimed at extending healthy human lifespan. And in that work, there's a lot of different aspects of that research, driving investment, news, advocacy and outreach, and doing a lot of content on YouTube channels that have a lot of subscribers. In addition to that, I also am a technology inventor and have worked for some large entertainment and tech companies like MLB, HBO, and most recently Disney, inventing some metaverse-adjacent technologies that you may may or may not be using, depending on how much of a nerd you are. And most recently, all of these worlds are kind of joining in a confluence around decentralized science and blockchain technology.
Mm-hmm. And what got you hooked to work on especially Lifespan.io, since that's going to be somewhat of the focus of this conversation?
Sure. I would like to think that any deeply thinking person would come to the conclusion that it's really important to work on aging research. But I can't deny that I had some personal experiences early in my life that probably got me thinking about that really early. Most notably, when I was a young child, some of my close family members had died. And that got me really kind of thinking about mortality at a very young age. And, you know, that it might be a good idea to try to work against the diseases of aging. And then what sort of really sealed the deal for me was when I was in my early 20s, my grandmother had like severe protracted Alzheimer's disease. And that really convinced me that even if you wanted to rationalize some kind of place for death in society, no matter what, there's like no rationalization for those diseases. And they definitely have to be fought against.
Yeah. So to focus more on longevity research right away, you've priorly spoken about the importance of, in your words, grounding emerging technologies in our shared human history. And I thought that was quite interesting. I'd like to start off asking about this, because in my experience, it's not a super common interest within tech to kind of like focus on the past and how technologies fit within kind of like you say, the shared past. So first of all, how do you conceive of the role of studying history within tech? And do you see a lack thereof in that industry?
Yes. No, this is a really excellent question. Thank you for asking. Why I personally feel that it's very valuable to kind of have this historical perspective is as an advocate, especially when a field is going through the process of maturation and there's still an educational process for the public, it's very useful to be able to point to historical precedent and to position what you're working on as part of like the long arc of history instead of something new and wild and crazy, so it can be much more accessible to people, right? So as an example, this is why it's very important to pair life extension with just the broader mission of medicine and improving health, human health, because no one has any arguments with that. And you can say, hey, listen, trying to extend our healthy human lifespan isn't really only transhuman. It is human. You might even say that using our tools to better our situation, which includes fighting diseases, is kind of what defines humanity. So that can really help to position it. And to answer your second question or second part of the question, this is an area where I feel like there can be some lacking in the field. And that's why it's very important to have artists and philosophers to be part of the field, to be able to speak emotionally to the public and connect this scientific mission with something really lived that people can understand it and understand that they actually do want it.
And why do you feel like that comparative neglect actually exists within tech of history? What made you recognize its value where others didn't pay attention?
Sure. Part of it was out of a necessity of just trying to be a successful advocate and studying what works. And this kind of runs into the science of like cognitive biases and how you actually can reach people. And sometimes just, you know, giving a sheet of the data isn't enough. You have to figure out how to make a narrative connection, right? So that's very, very important. And I feel like, you know, there's also a broader kind of educational gap that this is a particular instance of the broader issue of information silos, right? That this can happen specifically in terms of particular research, but this can also happen in terms of like what you do day to day. You know, very few researchers, for example, have the innate skill to be able to communicate that to the public and excite people because they're just, you know, just leave me alone. I want to focus on the bench work, right? So I think it's very important to either help, in this case, researchers be able to do that, which can also help with investment, or if they don't want to do that, be able to work with them to do that for them in a sense.
Yeah. Do you feel like there's good organizations or maybe even individual researchers that you kind of feel like have mastered this especially well in the last few years or within your career really?
Oh, yeah. There's certainly some out there that have a good, I guess you could say, social presence or propensity to engage the public. Obviously, David Sinclair is out there a lot. His book, Lifespan, has got a lot of people into the field. Brian Kennedy, you know, has his podcast. And in terms of like organizations, you know, I'm happy to say that there's a lot of new organizations popping up every day to try to make that narrative or fill that narrative gap. And one of them that, you know, I'm a part of as well is, of course, VitaDAO, in addition to Lifespan.io. And I think you know, maybe I'm drinking my own Kool-Aid, but I think we're all doing a pretty good job so far. Not that it can't be better and we can do more, but so far so good.
Yeah. How would you, maybe focusing on especially life extension, how would you kind of characterize the history of attitudes toward life extension, kind of taking this broader historical view?
Yeah, well, to go all the way back to the beginning, I always like to talk about the Epic of Gilgamesh, right? One of the very first great works you know, produced by human civilization. And it's all about this, right? You know, basically a king who starts out as a tyrant, but that's another question. His best friend dies and he just cannot believe it. There's a really moving scene where he's kind of holding the body of his friend for 7 days until like maggots are like literally coming out of his eyes until he believes that his friend is gone. And then he's like, you know, F this, you know, let's figure out a way to solve this problem and goes on this quest. So the reason why I bring this up is that it's important to note vis-a-vis the earlier conversation, that this desire is built into human history. But even though the first stories were kind of going after the thing itself, over the arc of human history until very recently, it's been an impossible goal. So we've developed all of these societal coping mechanisms, the biological clock is immutable, and people out of necessity have all these kind of rationalizations of like, oh, the golden years are going to be great, or not that people can't enjoy them, but, you know, like, oh, well, you know, I got to live in the moment, I shouldn't worry about this, or I'm going to get bored, or like all these kind of things. But what I've personally found as an advocate kind of on the front lines is that when you really talk deeply to people, almost all of those excuses, I guess you could say, or reasons really just melt away the instant someone actually thinks that it's possible. Right. So I think to answer your question now in a more precise way, over the last 10 years, I think that's really what's been starting to change is that there's been, you know, it started kind of slowly from 20 to 10 years ago. But every year since then, it's really kind of accelerating where the conversation has really moved, I think, for a large swath of the public to this is impossible to, okay, maybe it's possible, but do I really want it or is it only going to be for the rich? So we're kind of at the next phase. And now it's on us as advocates continuing the mission to really convince the public that, no, this is desirable. This could be for everyone. This could be actually amazing and inspiring and give us all more time to spend with our loved ones. Like, we should do it, right?
Mm-hmm. And where do you kind of see maybe a limit to life extension kind of in your own view? Like, I often feel like there's kind of differing definitions of what people are actually talking about when they're talking about life extensions, even within kind of our circles of DSI and such. For you yourself, like, what are you talking about? Because obviously, you know, from like 120 years to 500 to, you know, people who don't want any limits at all. I'd be curious where you fall into.
Very good question. And I know sometimes people kind of dance around the answer, so I'll give you a very direct answer, but then I'll justify it. From my personal perspective, the way that I like to phrase it is indefinite, is that I currently love life voraciously, and I don't expect that that's going to change. And I want to defer that decision until my future self, right? And give my future self that choice as long as my future self wants to have that choice, right? And I want to extend that choice to everybody who wants it. And whatever everyone wants to do with that choice is up to them. So indefinite is my personal answer. Now, to kind of temper that, I think it's also important to be realistic with expectations. So if people are asking me, like, what do you think is going to happen in the next 20 years or whatever, I think it's going to be a phased process, right? We're not going to have a magical pill within 5 years that's suddenly going to make you live to be 5,000. But I think now we're starting to see the fruition of some therapies that are going to push that boundary a little bit, maybe give you 2 to 3 years. And then in that time, maybe we develop better senescence therapies that then push it 5, 10 years. So I think there's a good chance through bootstrapping for some of us who are alive today to live a very long time. But once we get past that kind of near term, I don't know if there are any limits that we haven't yet uncovered. Maybe when we knock out the comparatively easier barriers, although they're all somewhat difficult, I don't know if there's a limit to how long neurons can live or this and that. You know, we'll have to find that out. But so in that, you know, I don't want to give too precise of an estimation there, but I'm optimistic, and there's every reason in the world to work as hard as we can now to uncover the next layer of the onion and keep seeing how we can do.
Yeah. And maybe turning more toward decentralized science as a whole, are you aware of predecessors of particular elements of decentralized science as well, not yet leaving kind of the historical grounds? And if so, what might have been their respective strengths and weaknesses? What can we learn from the past?
Another great question. So I'm not sure if you had attended the conference that we put on earlier in the year, the Ending Age-Related Disease Conference, but this was actually part of my opening talk, exactly this. And I had, if anyone wants to Google it, I forget the exact title, but I had written a book chapter in Jay Olshansky's book on gerontology that's all about like the history of crowdfunding and crowdsourcing in aging science. So this is the deep answer to your question, but the summary is, yes, there's precedent, I'm sure, going back further, but going back to the 1700s where there was like inducement prizes. I think it was like 1790 or something like that. There was a prize for like who can develop the best, you know, sail for a boat or something. I'm sure I messed that up. But that was kind of like the first example of almost like modern crowdfunding and crowdsourcing. But then in terms of science and DSI in general, again, the value of connecting it to history, it's very interesting to note the parallels between the earlier open science movement, things like Sci-Hub and Alexander Alcabon, you know, trying to get the information out there to the public, then kind of seceded by the citizen science movement, which I was a part of at the Citizen Science Lab GenSpace, right, which is all about everyday people without any kind of, you know, formal experience coming in and doing like wet work in the lab and learning how to do this. So I think, yes, like those are the predecessors, and it's very important for us as the modern DSci community to leverage that for two reasons. One, we have a whole cohort of people that we can bring in that are already kind of up on this. And two, it again makes it less weird and scary to like regulators and stuff. Like, oh, we've been doing this for 30 years. This is just the latest incarnation of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you feel like those projects that you mentioned, and you could focus on any one of them, GenSpace, for example, do they have weaknesses that you feel like we can actually kind of extract and apply to what we know about how to kind of go about DSI and what to evade?
So yes, I would say the weaknesses for the earlier movements is similar to the weaknesses that can present in DAOs, which is a lot of excitement, a lot of energy, but sort of a cacophonous energy, right? How do we organize it in actual productive steps? And that requires like, you know, the boring side of things, the project management, the task management, and the roadmaps, and this and that, where a lot of times when someone gets into the funnel, they're just like ready to rock and roll and do their own thing, which is great. So then the question is, like, how do you keep that energy, but then make sure that everyone is working decentralized, but together in a unified purpose? So, and I think we're working on that as a community, but that's the major challenge, I think.
Yeah. And this might already be part of the answer, but maybe there's more, so I'll ask the question anyway. What's been to you maybe the strongest critique of DSI so far? And related, maybe what do you think critics actually get wrong about DSI?
Yeah, I think in terms of critiques, that's certainly one of them that is valid. And then another critique that I think is somewhat false is that that it's going to be like slipshod or shoddy because it's a bunch of citizens or it's not the walled garden people doing it, so it's going to be a bad job. I think that's kind of a faulty critique. The valid critique is the chaotic energy, and another valid critique is currently a tendency because of that first thing to create duplication of effort. You might have 18 different DAOs that are doing the same thing, right? Where I think one of the eventual end goals and what will happen when DeSci is done right is that you cut down on that duplication of effort because everyone's doing their own beautiful thing and interoperating together in the right way, like due to like the meta scaffold of DeSci. So I think that's a valid critique, and we all got to work on that. Like before you go start the next DAO, like do a survey and see like is someone right next to me doing that same thing? Maybe I just help them, right?
I feel like the founder kind of complex is sometimes getting in the way of that. Everyone wants to kind of like be the first doing the, or even if you're not the first, like at least like having authority doing the thing. Given your work's focus and its affinity to new technologies like blockchain and new organizational models like you say, how do you have experience interacting with leaders of old institutions, say the NIH or the FDA? What have been the attitudes you encountered from them, in respect to your work, and what may be like misconceptions about those industries that either you yourself have encountered, or maybe others like in your circles have encountered as well?
Another fascinating question, and I believe I can speak with some authority on this because I've dealt with a lot of different representatives and leaders of different agencies. And what I have to report from the boots on the ground is positive, right? I think that there's a tendency, certainly in like the blockchain world, of thinking that like these old archaic institutions are like, as a rule, against this kind of rock and roll science and all that kind of stuff. But I haven't found that. I think the enemy there is like bureaucracy and infrastructure, like the actual like old technology and old like, but the individual like people that I talk to are like, wow, like this is amazing. Like help us, like how do we adopt some of what you're doing, right? So the takeaway message there is that I think that currently, yes, there's some drag force there. But I think, with new initiatives like ARPA-H, for example, right, that are ostensibly supposed to be moonshots and adopting new technologies, there's a real opportunity for people like us to proactively message them and say, hey, have you guys thought about this? Can I help you with this, et cetera, and steer those ships in these directions. So like that's my takeaway message is like there's a lot that you can do if you want to accelerate that stuff.
Between you and the people that you work with, could be, within like partnering with the older institutions, could also be within DeSci, whatever's most interesting, perhaps. What's the most contentious topic that repeats itself when you're debating your project? What's your main disagreement with other people there?
Sure. I would say one that always kind of pops up is like what terms we should use and like whether, for example, aging needs to be classified as a disease or not. Is that beneficial? Is that going to cause ageism? So that's one of the issues where there's like a lot of strong feelings kind of on both sides of the fence. And there's arguments, there's valid arguments to kind of both. So I think then it becomes like a problem-solving exercise of like how do you get the benefits of both sides, right? And then so that's kind of a narrative sort of social contentious point. And then in terms of like more nitty-gritty research, one debate that I find fascinating is like whether aging is programmed or not, right? That's something that comes up a lot. My personal opinion there is that I think it's longevity or that has evolved. Like if you go back to the initial like thermodynamic birth of life or whatever, you're starting from zero and then something blips into existence for a few seconds and some bubble and then microorganisms and this and that. So from my perspective, it's clear that length of time of survival is something that is built up from zero, and then there are like limiting conditions that work against it. You're not starting from immortality and being programmed to restrict you, right? That's actually interesting to note. That's actually kind of I don't know if this kind of informs some of the calcified views that we were talking about earlier of like people thinking that the biological clock is immutable and stuff. But what's interesting to note there, sorry, I got a little excited, is there's a confluence there with some religious ideas, and that might have subconsciously influenced those people like 100 years ago or like 50 years ago. So it's this idea called declinism, which comes up in a lot of religions that in the dawn of time you had the immortal primordial gods of order and chaos. And then there was the Titans who lived 100,000 years. And then there was the Olympians that lived 50,000 years. And then humans, which lived 100 years. So it's like you're starting from immortality. And like by the time you get to humans, it's been programmed down. But I as mentioned, I hold the opposite view personally.
That's quite interesting. Are there other religious kind of parallels that you're seeing within like kind of contemporary, maybe more mainstream still views on aging? Because I'm sure like religion has infiltrated, obviously, all kinds of different practices and beliefs that even being like in a more secular society nowadays, like we still kind of hold on because that's the water that we as fish are like born into and we can't really tell it apart.
Yes. So what I'm about to mention isn't per se a religion, but it's a theory that relates to a lot of religions, and you might have come up before in some of your interviews, terror management theory, you know, which has this root or has its root in this, I believe it was like a 19, can't remember exactly when it was, but it was this book by this cultural anthropologist, Ernst Becker, who basically, I'm paraphrasing it greatly, right? But it's basically that deep down in like your subconscious shadow, you're aware that your life is finite. And you're trying to like deal with that terror. And whether you realize it or not, almost everything that you do is rooted in the mitigation of that fear. Like, this is why you want to have children. This is why you want to do great work so your name is on a school somewhere. And in a way that affects, I believe, everyone, including myself, you know, this is kind of where like where you tell yourself those things of like, oh, well, even if I die, like I've done good works, like the waves of my existence have permeated in some way and I've mattered, right? Which I think is valid. But I think that idea of like having your existence matter in some way that is eternal, religion is one way of fulfilling that. And I believe that if you're really contending with life extension and aging, you're almost choosing in a sense to like not be satisfied with that and like look at the problem directly and like take on like terror harnessing and like using that terror to fight against the negative effects of what it could bring for you in society. So like turning it into like jujitsuing it into something instead of like ignoring it and pretending it until you're 90 years old and you're sick and you're like, oh my God, this sucks. I should have made different choices in my life, you know?
Yeah. Maybe going off that tangent, and I know there's, you know, a lot in between, and research is not quite advanced enough even to really ask this question without it being sort of silly. But do you feel like if there are no limits anymore? Because I definitely agree with that view that you just presented of like, you know, death kind of probably implicitly motivating you to do things in the first place and to appreciate life and such. Without limits, like, do you ever ask yourself that question of what would happen to your own kind of excitement and like urge to kind of like propel forward and do things in the world?
Yes, I think, again, this is like a fascinating topic. This is, in my opinion, one of the like critiques or the commentaries on aging that has like real teeth and you have to engage with it philosophically, where some of them are like easily dismissible, like overpopulation. But like this one's got meat to it, right? So yeah, I think I'm going to answer this in kind of like a tangential way, but then I'll bring it back to the point, maybe somewhat obnoxiously, because this is a thought that I actually had as a child, which is totally obnoxious. When I was a kid, you know, I'm very curious, right? As you could probably tell, and I have a lot of interests. I have a lot of, you know, I've developed a lot of expertise. And when I was younger, I literally remember having these thoughts like, what happens when I know everything? like, am I going to be like super depressed? You know, like whatever. And then the answer to that question is the same as the answer with life extension, is that at some point, you know, I got hit with the hubris stick or whatever, or just learn that like, even if somehow you could learn everything there was at this moment in the universe is dynamic and changing. 2 years from now, there's going to be things that I could learn and do that don't even exist now. You know, so like the sense that you could ever, if you're really out there and curious, that you're ever going to run to the end of that pot is like impossible. So that's what, you know, I really think that I'm always, in fact, I'm always pressed by the negative side of that, of going like, there's so much I want to do. And like, there's not enough time. I need more time so that I can do all the things that I want to do, or like, or you know, even just like personal things, like finding true love or something like that. That might be something that takes 10,000 years, you know, if you don't want to rush it. You know, I'm being a little bit fanciful here, but these are thoughts that actually work their way in my mind. And just as a little bit of a caveat, I want to say that I do think for some people, and maybe even myself in that way, having a limited lifespan can be a powerful driver. This works its way in mythology a lot as well, or even Lord of the Rings. You know, the elves who live 3,000 years, you know, they slack off, but the humans with their limited lifespan, you know, they got to get stuff done. So I think it's fair to say that that can be a motivator. But my difference there is I don't think it has to be anywhere near the only motivator and is a not necessary motivator if you are motivated by other things.
Mm-hmm. But you think like the existence of a limit as such, and perhaps even a limit, obviously, like at some point limits kind of cease to really represent anything meaningful of like a constraining force in our minds. If it's like, you know, 50,000 years, like we can't even fathom of such a thing. So, but do you feel like that is quite important still, or like it's kind of like having that or not having that, that kind of seems significant?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the answer is that it's not necessary. But I do think about it in the sense of, this is, again, kind of like a little bit arrogant or whatever to even think about this stuff. But one of the things that I do worry about is like the entropy heat death of the universe trillions of years in the future, because I don't like that idea. Very similar to, I'm not sure, I don't want to name the names because I don't want to like spoiler alert anyone. But like there are a few movies out there that I really like that might have something that happens at the end where like everyone's memory is wiped or something like that. And then that always leaves you with the feeling like, well, why did I watch this? Like, why did I get invested if like there's no memory of anything that happened? And I don't like the idea of that happening at the end of the universe. So that's the long goal. But, you know, there's a lot of steps before that.
Sure. Maybe taking a meta view on your career, have there been particular challenges that have time and again haunted you throughout your career, like some structural challenge that keeps reappearing or some other thing that just nags you?
Yes. Bureaucracy. Not the people, the systems. Just, I can't tell you even now how much of my time is just like wasted on like doing the taxes or like, you know, these kind of questions that pop up, or like you send a letter to some government agency and it comes back like 8 months later, like you didn't do the thing and you got it like, but I did do the thing, you know, like that kind of stuff that just like eats up your time. So that's going to be a big lift to change. But there is a lot of that I think the technologies that are emerging from decentralized science that if adopted could really help to expedite some things. To give an example, it's not exactly the bureaucratic element, but to give you one example of something I'm working on personally is essentially like a non-invasive physiological biomarker unit, you know, that can just rapidly assess your face, your voice, your walking gait, privacy preserving, all that stuff, and like immediately tell you whether it's likely that you have COVID, what your biological age versus chronological age is. And where it dovetails into this conversation or this point is I've been talking with a lot of people in the government about what are the steps necessary to get something like this standardized and like mandatorily adopted as part of every clinical trial. So then everything becomes standardized. Every trial becomes a de facto aging trial. Investors or, you know, companies and startups would like that too, because it gives every therapy a secondary indication to accidentally succeed upon. So like that's an example of like something that would have a massive benefit, but it has these bureaucratic roadblocks. And then I don't know if this was a tangent, but I could also speak to like I was involved somewhat in the COVID defense and some issues that presented with that and how we can maybe overcome them. I don't know if you want me to follow up with that or not.
Yeah, no, definitely.
All right, it's perfect. So I'm trying to choose my words carefully here, but so basically what had happened when COVID was first starting to really flare up, you might have seen that there was a lot of different initiatives out there that were working on non-invasive diagnostics for COVID, like voice. And I had invented some of that technology myself. If anyone's curious, you can search my name on Google Patents and you'll find one that's relevant. But in that work, I had interfaced with a lot of different organizations, some governmental, some international, some universities. And two things jumped out at me right away. Number one, these organizations didn't know each other existed. And as a consequence of that, they were all collecting just ever so slightly different data sets for no scientific reason. As a result of that, none of them were able to get enough data to train their machine learning models effectively, and they all failed in the time of critical need. Where if literally there was just some organizing or decentralized repository that was saying, okay, here's the standards, everyone collect this maximal data set and it will strengthen all of your own proprietary systems. You know, I don't want to like oversell it, but like that could have saved like hundreds of thousands of lives. And just the lack of like something very bureaucratic and simple could have had an immeasurable loss of life. And like that, when I saw that, I was like, okay, we really got to get serious about this.
Yeah. What do you wish maybe you knew 10 years ago? Flexible timeline here, but kind of important, impactful concept changes that you went through within your own career.
Okay, it's going to sound a little bit, cliche or Pollyanna-ish, but it is the answer to this question. I wish I would have known earlier that the fastest way to start making a real difference in the world is to just start immediately and to just ask for help immediately. Where it's so easy to say, well, I want to affect aging research, so I need a PhD, so I got to go here and I got to do this, and like to create this kind of roadmap that's going to take like 10 years. And sometimes that's the way it's got to be, like in the case of research. But not that everything he's done is correct, but Steve Jobs has a good example here, where I think he tells a story where when he wanted to get involved with computers, he literally just like wrote a letter to the head of Hewlett Packard, like, "Hey, I'm super curious. I think I can help. Can you help me?" And then they just like sent him a bunch of computers, right? So my advice to myself, and my advice to younger people, is generally like find whoever is doing the thing that is the closest thing to your dream, and just like go ask them how you can help. And that passion and curiosity and follow through is far more important than your existing skill set.
Yeah, maybe connecting to that and making that question more explicit. How can young people help? What would you recommend someone just starting out, like in terms of resources, places to go to? Like besides just starting, where shall they start? How to direct their energies maybe into particular things?
Yeah, I think to tie this to some of the earlier questions, do a little bit of due diligence so that you don't duplicate somebody else's effort, right? But sounds stupid, but just like Google it, find out who's doing what you're trying to do, and join a community that's aligned, and then talk to people and find out what the gaps are so you can do something. And especially in decentralized science, like there's so much work to do. For the people that have been part of the field since the early days of like open science, it feels like it's big now, but compared to the public, it's still so tiny. So the point is, like if someone were to come up to me and say, "Hey, can I help lifespan.io? And I have this skill set. I can do videos, I can write articles, I can do blockchain technology, like almost anything," we'd be like, "Yes, we desperately need you." Right? So that ties to the earlier thing of just like find out who's doing what you want to do and just ask them, and is guaranteed, almost, well, I don't want to guarantee, but like close to guarantee, that something in there either matches your existing skill set or matches something that you're passionately interested in and could use someone without the existing skill set but has the passion to learn.
Go out there and talk to people. Can you think of any important questions, maybe lastly, that I've not asked you today? Is there anything left unaddressed that you really are dying to address?
Okay, I think it would be why the fruition of the goals of aging research is truly important to be accomplished for society. I think there's the obvious personal pain one. Should I go ahead and answer?
Please, yes, go for it.
So I think there are myriad reasons, right? Obviously there's alleviation of personal suffering, but there's also the macroeconomics, right? I don't know if this is like the proper PC term for it, but I don't know if there's a replacement term for the gray tsunami. This idea of the population demographics. There's in Japan, there's more people buying, old, older people buying diapers than babies, right? So like the point is that because of that happening, if you want Medicare for all, if you want all these kind of great things, or on the other side, if you want to have reduced lockdowns during COVID or whatever, we have to do this. Otherwise, we're in for like a world of hurt in like not too long of a future. And another point that I think is important is that this is actually very impactful for driving like equity, right? Like one of the examples I like to use is as part of Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign. This is one of the points that was brought up a lot, is that the burdens of an aging society are disproportionately borne by the elderly, sorry, or by the poor, women, by minorities. So if you want to really affect like income inequality, one way that's not obvious but super impactful is to equalize the damages of aging, right? So I think that's an important point to sort of connect this to broader missions. And on one last point there that's more inspirational and is again maybe my own view, but I hope it's true, is that in the olden days, hundreds of years ago, some aspects of religion would be helpful to people to have a sense of the eternal, or I might be involved in long-term works like building a cathedral, building a school that would take 300 years. Even though I'm going to die, the fruits of my work, you know, will live on in eternity and help other people, right? And I'm optimistic that as we proceed along this mission, if people really feel like they might be around in good health for a longer period of time, maybe we'll be better stewards of the earth. Maybe we will become more wiser or more wise in that time and, you know, be more kind. So maybe I'm being a little bit Pollyanna-ish there, but I believe that should be part of the inspirational message that we're selling here, is that fundamentally life is good. And that is why we want to give everyone the choice to have more of it so that we can do more good things with that life.
Yeah. That's a wonderful way to end it. Keith, thanks so much for being here today. I really enjoyed talking.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.